Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Iron Hack Podcast. As always, I'm DevOps Dan.
And I am Ternary Tim.
And this is the last in our Tech Careers series, so we thought we'd go out on a bit of a bang, would you say, Tim? You call it a bang?
Yeah, I think so. I'd say that our guest today is a bit of a bang.
So we have the co-founder here with us today. Ariel, say hello, Ariel.
Hello, guys. How are we doing today?
Pretty good.
Yeah. So rather than me ruin your own introduction, why don't you tell us all who you are, where you are, and what you do?
Awesome. Let's do it. First of all, guys, I was getting a little bit worried that 70 episodes in, it's about 70, right? I wasn't going to get the invite.
Yeah, 70 episodes. Yeah. Well, you know, we're focused on students and their stories, you know.
I'm glad I made it before the 100th episode. Thank you so much for all you do.
If you joined the boot camp, you probably would have been fast-tracked to the front of the queue.
That's how it works, man.
That's awesome. But seriously, awesome work and really appreciate it. So I'm the co-founder, co-CEO of Iron Hack. You had the chance to speak to my co-founder, Gonzalo, I think year and a half ago, right?
Something around episode 20, I think. Long time ago, it feels like.
So hopefully I don't repeat a lot of the talking points and messages from that conversation.
Well, look, if any of our listeners are still listening from then, you know, then that's
back.
Yeah, that's a big treat.
I hope there is some listeners out there who are going back to their notes. It's like, right, let me check.
Yeah. Has it repeated anything from 2020? Yeah.
So I'm originally from Puerto Rico. And I think Gonzalo mentioned in his episode, I come from a household of educators. Both parents were teachers at some point in their lives. My father actually started a vocational school that ended up evolving into a university. So even though I didn't have formal background in education when I started Iron Hack, I was very much immersed in that world through my family. I moved to Boston, Massachusetts from San Juan, a big contrast in weather. I know you guys like to talk about the weather.
It's just part of being English, I think.
I really thought it was an English thing, but since living in Germany, I think it's more of a German thing than an English thing.
I think it's a human thing. Everyone talks about the weather. It's the easiest thing.
It's also a thing in the Northeast in the US, by the way.
Okay.
So I spent pretty much most of my early adulthood in the Northeast between Boston for university, New York City for work, Philadelphia for my MBA program where I met Gonzalo, right?
Yeah.
And then I think around 27 years of age, I had a little bit of an existential crisis. I was a banker on Wall Street working, you know, 100 hours a week. Oof. And I realized at that point that that wasn't my purpose in life and that I wanted to do something entrepreneurial. So at that point, I started thinking about what was next for me.
Is this the plot of Wolf of Wall Street? It sounds exactly like the beginning of Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you sell me this pen?
Working a little bit harder and slightly less fun. And then went to business school to incubate a business, ideally an education business. And that's how I got started. You know, the last thing I'll say about myself is I'm a lifelong learner. So I get a lot of joy from building an education venture, right? And also, I am a career changer myself. So I have tremendous respect and empathy for the journey of thousands of our graduates, right, that come from different backgrounds and are taking a leap into the exciting world of tech, right? So it's something that's very near and dear to my heart.
Very cool. Yeah, I think Marielle last week, actually, when she came on the show, she was talking about being a career changer herself. And I think for people that are at the helm, I think it's very important that you kind of got firsthand experience of what it means. Because I think with hindsight, it looks very different. If you've never done it before, it's very scary. But I think if you've got hindsight and you can say, okay, this is what happened with me, then you can advise and kind of guide people way more accurately. So that's cool that you did that. So I guess that kind of gives us a little bit of a run up to you joining Iron Hack. But what did you do What do you do day to day? What's your kind of like day to day work as a founder at IronHack?
Sure. And the first caveat I'll say is that the nature of the work, right, and the priorities of a founder evolve over time, right? So my day to day, 7-8 years ago, right, when we were early in the journey, was completely different than
4 years
ago. And I'm actually in a transition point right now. I'm actually onboarding a senior vice president of consumer who's going to be managing all of our campuses, including our remote offering. So now I'll be a little bit more distanced from the day-to-day management of general managers that run each of our markets and more focused on the big picture, right? And connecting the dots across the organization, right? And if I think of the 3-4 things that I'll be focused on the next couple of years, right? The first will be to continue shaping the vision, right, within the organization and generate excitement for that vision, right? I think one constant over the past almost decade, I've been the chief recruiting officer, if you want to make up a title, right, or the chief culture officer, right? For me, it's really important that we're very thoughtful about attracting and selecting the best people for the organization, right? And
is that recruitment for staff or recruitment for students?
Recruitment for staff.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then, so on campus managers responsible for recruiting the students, right? I'm responsible for leading with Gonzalo our executive team, right? And making sure that they do the best job possible in leading the rest of the organization, right? And finally, spend a bit of time raising capital and managing external stakeholders and make sure that we don't run out of money so we can continue growing and building on our vision.
Okay. And what part, so you said it changed, your roles changed a lot over the years. Is there a preference to like what you've enjoyed the most, the day-to-day work that you do? Is it like just exponentially become more like your wheelhouse, or was there a point maybe like a few years ago and you're like, that was the moment?
That's awesome. Awesome question. I think I'm getting into my natural wheelhouse now, right? If I think of the early days of IronHack, and you know, the experience that you guys had was very different, right, than those first cohorts, right? Like I think the first cohorts we would have like one lead teacher, right? And then Gonzalo and I would be admissions, program management, outcomes, career services, finance, right?
Just like looking in the door, making sure the students were okay.
I mean, it was hilarious.
Yeah. Come on, guys.
And I'm a bit nostalgic of those days, but that was really, I think, hard and not my natural state. Some people are, you know, super entrepreneurial from age 5, and by the time that they start their first professional business, they already had like 10 like informal ventures. That wasn't my background, right? So I think I'm getting now to a point where I know what it takes to be successful as an entrepreneur, but then I can also leverage the skills from my prior life, you know, working at a big company, right? Using my financial skills, my leadership and people management skills. So very excited about the next stage.
Okay, cool. So it's definitely like, that's crazy how much of a journey it's been, I guess. But it's cool that you've kind of found your pace now. That's awesome.
Yeah. How long has it been now? When did you found?
Found? Yeah, so...
when did you find IronHack?
Yeah, it's funny enough, there was a team the other day that by mistake sent out like a 10-year anniversary email, which is a year early.
very organized.
We'll get there. We had to recall that email. But we started working actually the last month of our MBA program, which was April of 2013.
Okay.
But we didn't have our first cohort till October of 2013.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So right. I'd say we'll probably celebrate it October of next year.
And where was the first campus? When did you decide like to? When was the very first one? It was like
was Madrid.
Madrid.
Just in your parents' house. Yeah. Come and sit on the couch.
It was Madrid, but it might as well could have been a garage shirt. Yeah. It was a really, really modest classroom. You know, we rented a dark room in a co-working space that I won't mention now after describing it as a very dark room in Madrid in 2013. And we had 13 insane students who took a courageous leap and believed in this idea that had no track record whatsoever, right? If I think of like Iron Hack at that time, you know, like we had no experience. We had no student testimonials. Mm-hmm. I don't think we had like a phone number on the website, right? So
yeah, it's always it's always the first cohort. How do you get students for that, right? Number one. That's the hardest one. No proof of concept really yet.
Oh no, it was like
Work, guys. Come on. It's just you saying to the students, come on, it's gonna work, get in here.
Oh my God. Trust us. It was such a stressful but exciting experience. And I gotta tell you, it's one of those moments in the journey of an entrepreneur and the journey of a company that are tremendously decisive, right, and influential for what's to come, right? If we don't get those first 13 students, I don't know that I would be here talking to you guys. I don't know that we would have this awesome community of 10,000 plus graduates. So yeah, really, really cool to look back at those days.
I always wonder though, like putting together any kind of like education system, especially a boot camp, what people are really paying for is the curriculum, right? And how did you first define a curriculum from start to finish? Because I don't think it's as easy as like, okay, web devs, let's start with HTML and then just move on through. You have to find, how do you make a lab? You know, how did you first put together this like set of classes was the first course is 12 weeks, I guess? 12 weeks was always been that long?
No, the first course was 8 weeks.
Okay, so over an 8 week period, that's a difficult thing to build, I think.
Yeah. And listen, the curriculum is tremendously important, right? We have an awesome curricula now, you know, across four programs, right? We have dedicated teams that are making sure that the contents, the competencies are matched to the market, right? So that's super important, right? You know, but I'll be honest with you and your listeners, right? Like obviously the first version of the curriculum, you know, was not the best, right? It was a minimum viable product, right?
Yeah.
Where we focused in the first, I'd say, 6 months were two things. Number one, making sure that the students reached their desired outcomes. So we went out of our way, you know, leverage our personal network to get them personal interviews, right? To bring great speakers, to connect them to the local community, right? And then secondly, deliver a best-in-class learning experience, right?
Yeah.
And after the first week of that first program, we did like a 360 feedback session. And we were so nervous, right? Because it was the first time we're not technical guys, Gonzalo and I, right? So we didn't have like great insight as to the learning progress, right, on the technical competencies, right? And it was crazy to hear some students talk about the best learning experience of their life, right? And we're talking about like the first version of the program, right?
Yeah. Cool.
From our personal vantage point, we felt that even some of the best educational institutions in the world were not customer-centric. We're not student-centric. Right. So we say, let's focus on making sure that we put the student at the center of the equation in everything that we do, right? Let's make sure that we get them a good outcome after the end of the program, right? And that's going to give us more students, right, and more capabilities to build a better curriculum, to build, to have better facilities, right, to have better marketing. And that spins the so-called flywheel, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting because now you're such an established global institution and like the outcomes, you know, are much, I guess, much easier now to guarantee than they were back then. So back then, were you just, was it you and were you just calling up companies like, look, I've just taught these guys web dev, literally. Trust me, they can code.
You know, literally, you know, in the beginning, I mean, keep in mind, this is very early in the boot camp world.
Yeah.
Right. If you think of the first boot camp in the US, Dev Boot Camp, I think it was founded in 2011. Right.
Right.
So,
okay.
So we're talking early. 2 years later, right? First to market in Europe. Spain was certainly not the Spain that we know now in terms of the maturity of tech ecosystem and the opportunities in IT and technology, right? Mm-hmm. So it was crazy to go to employers and say, like, you know, hire from this, like, you know, first or second cohort, right? Non-traditional education, you know, no 4-year degree or 5-year degree, right? So we literally had to use every little power that we had and unlock our network, even at a personal level, to open those first opportunities. Yeah. Obviously, with time, right, there's like a snowball effect, right? Like, they're happy with the first hire, right? And then they come to the second hire. But it takes years to do that. And that's why education can be tough, right? If you don't have a long-term view, right? And if you're not patient, right? Other types of businesses you can scale very quickly, right? I think it's harder to do in the type of education that we deliver.
Yeah, for sure. Because you're learning so fast. It's like you've got the tools. It gives you the tools to then build something. It's not like you're graduating with, you know, like a doctoral thesis under your belt. So it's like you've got to put those tools to practice to actually work out, you know, like where you're going to find your groove. And that's what we, you know, we spoke to so many people on the podcast who they might be like, now I guess it's different because people are like boosting their career. They're like learning to go back to jobs, but even the roles within tech are so diversified now that just graduating and then thinking, oh, in the next 8 weeks, I'm going to find the job that I'm going to have for the next 15 years. It's just not true. You know, I think with this like 6-month period afterwards, or even a year, that's when you're going to find the thing that education is going to really give you the boost in. So I totally agree with that. I think that's a story that we've heard.
I think this is a very important point for your listeners, right? Like, it's not a sprint, right? It's a lifelong journey, right? And if you're excited to, I mean, you guys know it better than anybody else, right? If you're excited to be in this world, right? Like, you always have to continue to innovate, right? Reinvent yourself, advance your skill sets, right? And we try to activate, right? That mindset, right? That state of mind for the rest of your career at R&D.
Yeah. And on the flip side though, just on that point of like how difficult it was in the first place versus now, and like this need to reinvent yourself all the time, do you think that actually makes it harder because there are more bootcamp students out there? It might be harder for them to stand out of a crowd of bootcampers. Do you think that means that you have to reinvent yourself more and more, or do you think that everybody's kind of standing on the same platform and rising up together?
I mean, not at all. Right. If you think of the number of graduates, we've seen tremendous growth in the bootcamp space for sure. Right. But if you think of the number of graduates relative to the addressable market, the number of opportunities out there, it's a drop in the bucket. Right. So I think the numbers that I remember from the 2021 survey were around 40,000 graduates in the U.S., globally, maybe you're talking about 2x that number, right?
It's still a very small amount of bootcampers.
Very small, right? Yeah. If you look at the skills gap and the anticipated skills gap by 2030, right? There's estimates of roughly 100 million, right? Wow. We're talking about 8.5 trillion.
Oof, get your boot camp in now then before it gets
Yeah. So I think there's two pieces, right? Like the number of new jobs created, right? Which you're talking about tens of millions. You know, we're not talking hundreds of thousands, tens of millions.
Yeah.
And also the amount of people that will have to reskill, right? And or slightly modify their skill set in order to be productive for the next 10, 20 years, right? Yep. So I think we're just getting started. And if anything, you know, those first 100,000 or a couple hundred thousand graduates of boot camps, I think they've paved the way in a way, right? So now larger corporates that were perhaps more traditional, more risk averse 10 years ago, right, feel comfortable hiring these type of learners, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Not only that, we have students, right, that did the program 8 years ago that are in a hiring position in those companies 8 years later.
Well, yeah, and then they'll see the IronHack thing and bring them on and see the name on there. It's very interesting that, so do you guys know who John Carmack is?
No.
He's the guy, he used to work for id Software. He coded like Doom and Quake back in the 90s. He's widely regarded as like one of the, quote, best programmers of all time. He came up with all this like 3D rendering for walls and stuff, made video games kind of what they are now. Now he's working in AR and VR. I was listening to an interview with him the other day on the Lex Fridman podcast, actually, Tim. It's a 5-hour interview. It's incredibly long.
Oh my God.
Yeah, but it's very interesting. He mentioned a few times like about how coding has changed. And he said a few times, yeah, you could get just someone, a boot camp nowadays, and bring them straight out of a boot camp and have them working on whatever. And I thought it was very interesting that if boot camps, what is it now? So 11 years since the very first boot camp maybe popped up, 2011. So in that time, like a boot camper has become one of the established ways into the whole industry, right? There's university, there's self-learning, and now you can be a boot camper. And I think that like the increase of in the public lexicon of like, oh, you're a boot camper, everyone kind of knows what that is now, and it's just exponential. And that's very interesting to hear how early it was, you know, how early it still is in the game.
Yeah, because you think about that, if you think about the person who did one of those early boot camps and now has 10 years experience.
Yeah, that's, well, exactly.
If we spoke to someone on the podcast with 10 years experience, we'd be like, oh my God, this guy.
Well, we interviewed the guy who was at Google for, 15 years. And yeah, that time is an incredible, it's like an age, because back when he started, like CSS didn't exist, you know, there was like just HTML, there's no JavaScript or whatever. Like,
well, I guess that's an interesting question is, you know, with the pace that tech moves, not just web development, but like with UX, UI, and I mean, God knows about cybersecurity. That's like, I guess that's like the fastest moving of all the boot camps. Do you feel the pressure to kind of like innovate consistently, or do you think it's good enough to, you know, give the students the basics to then build upon?
And not only do we feel the pressure, we thrive in that pressure.
Yeah. Okay.
Great answer. That's
next question.
Gold standard answer.
No, but I think that's a key capability, right? To be a leading player in this field, right? Like you have to move as fast as the market, right? And we always start with the market. That's how you become a good outcomes-driven organization at scale, right? And what's cool about us, right, Gonzalo and I, when we started, right, we didn't have any sort of technical programming background, right? And now looking back, we thought that was a weakness at the time, right? But looking back, in many ways, it was actually a blessing, right? Because we weren't committed or biased to delivering an education with a specific skills tech stack, right? We're gonna focus on closing the gap between the market, right, and the talent. And if that means that we have to go from Ruby on Rails to JavaScript because the market is going that direction, we will do that, and we'll do that swiftly. Right? And we've done that a number of times over the year, right? Yeah. And for sure, we'll continue doing it going forward. We'll go wherever the market is.
It's an interesting kind of topic, I think. There's that, what's that Steve Jobs quote about staying foolish? I think that like, I was listening to some interesting podcasts around the pandemic time when they were comparing, or they were talking about traditional education systems and how if you're a university graduate or you're going to university, how unbelievably difficult it was for those institutions to pivot into using new technologies and like, okay, this is going to be the future of work now. Like, it's not just going to be go to an office and work. It's like, you know, working from home and the tools that means. And I guess it's kind of adjacent to this because the students, the people that are kind of being pushed out of the course at the end are going to exist in a completely different world. And just the ethos was it wasn't student focused at all. It was like the focus was everywhere else. It's basically that they were trying to sort of save money, that they were trying to kind of convince people that it was something that it wasn't. And I think that's the really the interesting thing about boot camps, is because it's kind of this like crucible that you go through. It's like a very intense short period. It gives you guys the freedom to be able to kind of make that and change it very rapidly on the fly, and kind of innovate in the space very quickly. And I think the students kind of thrive on it as well. I think once they've got their head around this initial, like, oh my God, this is going to be so intense, and all these different pieces that kind of go together, I think, at the end of it, it's a very kind of tangible skill that they have. And it's not like, well, I've been doing it in this way for 3 years, so how the hell can I do something different? It's like, they're also ready to change. They're also ready to like learn something new as soon as they start a new job. I think that's really important. And maybe I wouldn't have seen it that way before I took my boot camp. I think it's only in hindsight that I think, okay, actually this is, I was always thinking, why can't I do 6 months learning? But now I realize that the short term thing and that kind of like that agility is very, very important.
Super important.
Yeah, for sure. And do you think that the pandemic, from your point of view, changed the learning experience or the kind of overall IronHack experience for the students?
Listen, so I think the answer to that question is probably nuance, right? Especially if you think of the broader learning market, right? You know, there's a lot of people who struggled on a personal level, right? During the pandemic, right? Felt disconnected from friends and loved ones, right? And we know what kind of impact that can have on learning outcomes, right? And learning experiences, right? There's, you know, for like early education, right? Elementary school, there was like crazy learning loss, right? In kids that were not well suited for like online learning, right? But if I think of our small pocket of the learning market, right? I think it's helped us tremendously, right? If you think of even IronHack, right? Pre-pandemic, we were an in-person learning institution, mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Now, roughly 40% of our learners are learning online.
Oh, so you didn't have the remote course before the pandemic?
We did not have the remote course.
Huh, okay.
For the pandemic.
Right. Yeah, right? Interesting.
The remote course was a response, a swift response to a crisis,
and a perfect response. It fits so well. I assumed you always had it offered, actually, because I came, two cohorts in, so, and it just makes so much sense.
So we always had the plan to do it, right? But I think there's two things that kept delaying it. One, our campus-based business was doing tremendously well and continued to grow, right? So it's really hard to say, like, all right, now let's try this other thing, right? Yeah. And secondly, I think deep down inside, we had this fear that the experience, the outcomes would be different, right? And the pandemic forced us to try this, right?
Yeah.
If we look back, you know, it was a really stressful time for us, right? But probably a blessing in disguise, right? That we were forced to test this out and demonstrate to ourselves and to our consumers, right, that the outcomes were there, that the experience was awesome, right, and then it was the better alternative for a lot of people out there.
So, oh, go on, Dan.
I was just going to say, like, I and so many people we've spoken to on the podcast, almost it's like a catchphrase of like, well, when the pandemic came, I decided to retrain. It's such a, we hear this phrase so many times now that it's almost like synonymous now, especially like the whole reason I'm here now is because pandemic came, the industry I was working in obviously took a hit. So I decided let's retrain, become a bit more future proof, you know? So
therefore, I think the pandemic accelerated trends that were already underway.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
It wasn't that the pandemic created online learning or the pandemic created remote work, right? But I think we saw in our space an acceleration of anywhere from 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Well, we interviewed someone who ran a primary school for children, remote primary school for children. Can you imagine how much convincing that would have taken?
Remote primary school,
can you imagine if it was just like no pandemic, no like remote first thing, being like, do you want your kids to go to a remote primary school? No. So yeah, I think 10 years seems to be the number that a lot of people mention, because
for sure
it's just accelerated so fast. But if the pandemic was kind of like a blessing in disguise for you guys, was there ever like a crisis that you thought, okay, this could be the moment, Iron Hack's dark day? Was there ever a point when it got really tough?
The pandemic as well.
Okay, you thought that might be the end, when it, you know,
the blessing early, in disguise, also not a blessing.
It was the first 4 months of the pandemic were really scary.
Yeah, I think, like, for everyone, obviously, but I can imagine exactly why.
For really scary, and I think when I heard Gonzalo speak on your podcast, I think it was like spring of last year, we were still dealing with PTSD, I think, from that. So I think he didn't want to revisit it too closely, right? But it was without question the toughest crisis that we've dealt with. You know, I'll share the story now, right? But we were very close to closing a funding round, right, at that moment, that was pulled, right, out of the blue. You know, capital markets closed for a period of 3 to 4 months. So then all of a sudden we didn't have funding, and we saw a massive decrease in applications and traffic and interest because the world was on hold, right? And we were reinventing ourselves from a campus-based program into hybrid or remote.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for a period, I'd say of 4 to 6 months, we were really scared. Right. But again, I think what we did really well was create this remote division. You know, we created a SWAT team of some of our best people, right, to innovate and create this online offering. Right. And when we got to November, December that year, that part of the business was already growing tremendously and putting really good numbers, which led to that 20 million round, right, that we announced in January of 21, right?
Yep.
So that was a year.
I think the reason why Gonzalo came on was because you just announced there was like a round of like 32 million that you just – was that? But that didn't –
Was 20, wasn't it? I remember something.
It was 20. Yeah. It was like – but at first, like a year before that, right? Like in March of 2020.
Yeah, that's when he came on.
The term sheet that was pulled. So all of a sudden we thought that we were going to have funding for the next 2 years. We don't have those resources. And then on top of that, we saw a 50% decrease
in
applications and enrollments.
Yeah, right? But you've just recently got a nice round, right?
Yeah. That was like... So well,
congratulations on that. But does that mean that the market's back now? Because I mean, the tech industry right now is in this like, you know, decline. There's this sort of lots of fear in the startup world. How is it affecting the educational tech world right now?
Yeah, so we closed that round. It's been a year and change now. So we closed that round in January of 21, right? I think without question, the market is in a very different place. Right now, I think the market's trying to figure out what's happening with the geopolitical issues, with inflation, with valuations, right? Mm-hmm. I'm still very bullish in the medium to long term, right? There's still a lot of capital to be deployed in great and exciting, innovative projects, right? But I think the market's trying to figure out, like, where are we going, right? And what is valuable and what is not, right? And at what levels, right? Mm-hmm. So I think for us, thankfully, we're well capitalized, right? And growing, not looking to do any sort of financing. You know, this year, we'll probably revisit that question in 2023, depending on the state of the markets.
And is your plan next? Is there any non-secret plans you can share with us on today?
Are there any secret plans you can share?
Yeah, secret ones. Yeah, better ones. What's next for Iron Hack?
Let's start with a non-secret. So listen, two things that are really exciting for us. One, continue growing our remote offering and reach folks that are not in our 9 physical cities. Okay.
Right.
Okay. We're starting to see tremendous interest from smaller cities or even rural areas, right, in the markets that we're operating, right? And we see an opportunity to increase that by 10x in the next couple of years, right? So I think we're going to be in a place a couple of years from now where the vast majority of our learners are online or hybrid learners, right, that potentially come to one of our campuses for a couple of days, a couple of weeks, right? But the vast majority of the learning experience will be delivered remotely, right? The second part that we're incubating and starting to generate traction is B2B training and B2B talent acquisition solutions, all right? And what I like about this, think of the really large corporates that are looking not for 1 or 2 students from a career week, but they're looking for 30, 40, 100 students per quarter,
yep.
Right?
Yeah.
So we as an organization want to get really close to those companies and to the hiring managers of those companies, right? So that we act as an additional pipeline. You can think of it a talent pipeline as a service, right? And what I love about that is that we're actually creating more value for our bootcamp graduates, right?
Yep, of course, yeah.
In having proprietary pathways to some of the best opportunities out there, right? So I think big area of focus for the years to come is how do we gain as much market share, right, of job vacancies, right? So that our graduates have the best opportunities, right? And the closest proximity to those opportunities right after the programs.
It's a really interesting offering for students as well, because I think there's some people who would enjoy the kind of vague outcome, you know, like you're going to do the boot camp and then you're out in the world and you're going to just try and find your way with the skills that you have, which might be very daunting for some people. But then for some, you know, when you say, okay, you're going to be doing this boot camp for Amazon or something, and you know that, you know, at the end of the course is going to be a job waiting for you, then that's like, I mean, for some people, that's like a huge benefit. You know, if you don't want that, like, you don't want that, like, personal learning curve of job searching, you know, so that's very cool.
Yeah. We don't take a position on what type of job, Tim, you should get after the program.
Yeah.
Right. We have a very diverse universe of learners with very diverse objectives and personalities and ambitions, right? So for us, what's really important is that we have a diversity, a wide range of possible outcomes so that you can get closer to your personal goals, right? Not us telling you, you know, you need to do startups or you need to do a large corporate or you need to be an entrepreneur, right?
Yeah, it's a fine line, right? Because as part of it, it's like who can hire you? What can you do straight out of a boot camp? Which companies are available that you can jump into, as well as also giving students these tools to kind of do what they want? Like, there's nothing stopping a student coming to learn how to be a developer and then go and build their own product and just go straight into entrepreneur. There's nothing to stop you doing that after IronHack. You know, yeah. Equally, you could go into a junior role in an SME or something. It's really just a case of like giving them the tools to do that in the best possible platform. That's a very fine line to do from an educational institution perspective. Mm-hmm.